Kevin Stefanski and Andrew Berry, do you think that they are good at what they do?
Yeah, I think so. Well, Stefanski, two-time coach of the year. Andrew Berry, I don't know. Do we blame the Haslams for the Deshaun Watson debacle?
The questions and the criticisms are more about ownership than anybody on the sideline or in the GM.
He's the head coach of a franchise owned by Jimmy Haslam, so who knows? If you put him in a more stable situation with a less volatile compound in the owner's box, maybe you'd get more.
The Ken Carmen Show with Anthony Lima on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your podcasts.
This podcast is brought to you by the Village of Bedford Park, your home for business. Over 450 businesses strong and growing with a safe, reliable Lake Michigan water supply. Visit VOBPbiz.com and bring your business home to the Village of Bedford Park.
Now, the WBBM Noon Business Hour.
Chicago's Potbelly sandwich chain has been bought by the operator of convenience stores. We'll cover that in our next segment. But first, inflation eased last month, with producer prices unexpectedly dipping as businesses absorbed tariff costs, raising hopes inflation is contained, at least for now. Joining us on the Village of Bedford Park business line, reminding you to bring your business home, is Andrew Bush, former Chief Markets Intelligence Officer at the Commodity Futures Trading Commission and economic futurist at andrewbush.com, based in Charlotte, North Carolina. Andy, thank you for joining us today. It seems like there are two interpretations of this producer price index report that showed producer prices falling by 0.1% in August, annual rate of 2.6%, down from 3.1% in July. On the one hand, you could say the hit from tariffs hasn't arrived yet, or it's not as bad as originally thought. Option number two is it just shows the economy is weakening.
Yeah, I think it's a combination of the two, to be honest. First of all, the reciprocal tariffs only went into effect August 7th, and the copper tariffs went in August 1st. So it takes a little while because firms will have had inventory that they, stockpiled. They'll work through that first before they really start to feel or price in some of the tariff stuff. So I think we still have inflation in the pipeline. The economy is without question slowing. I mean, the BLS jobs data that was revised showing almost a million less jobs created over the last, 18 months. That really shows that that the economy has not only not been very good, not only under the first couple of months of the Trump administration, but specifically under the Biden administration. So going into this year, it was slowing already. And I think the uncertainty being generated by these tariffs is going to make it slow even further.
And then what does this mean for the consumer price index report that comes out later this week?
Yeah, I mean, it's expected to be up 0.3%. Again, I don't see this thing jumping significantly. But the tariffs take a little while to work in. So you're going to start to see these one-time bumps to the CPI probably in the back half of this year, more along the lines of November and December. What's interesting is that, we've seen interest rates decline already. Part of that has to do with the BLS data. Part of that has to do with the expectations that the Fed's going to cut interest rates next week. And really, they'll probably cut three times this year. I don't expect a 50 basis point rate cut next week, but, the Fed could do a lot of different things. But I think three is probably what they're going to do.
And then when assessing the inflation from tariffs that could show up on an inconsistent basis in the inflation reports going forward, how does this differ from the inflation that began to settle in 2021 and 2022 that just seemed to, once it got going, it took a number of interest rate hikes to slow it down?
Yeah, I mean, the Fed back then was really sitting on their hands and made a huge mistake in policy. They kept interest rates at zero. They kept quantitative easing, even though you were getting 5% GDP growth. So that was a huge mistake. And they expected inflation to just be contained in the durable goods area or the goods section. But that's not what happened. We had the outbreak of the war, and then everything broke loose because energy costs slid into the rest of the economy. And then it just kind of all blew up. So the Fed reacted, eventually raised rates, 525 basis points over 14 months. But the die was cast. Once inflation gets into the economy, it's really tough to get it out. And that's the major takeaway I want everybody to understand. Even if we get a slowing CPI number tomorrow. The problem is prices have risen significantly and they have not come down. That's the problem for low-income and middle-income earners. They've seen grocery prices go up. They've seen car prices go up. You name it, it's all gone up, and they're not really getting any relief. So that's the major problem when it comes to the economy right now.
Andrew Bush, former Chief Markets Intelligence Officer at the Commodity Futures Trading Commission and economic futurist at andrewbush.com, based in Charlotte, North Carolina. Thank you for joining us today.
The WBBM Noon Business Hour continues.
Born in a Lincoln Park antique shop with a potbelly stove, then eventually becoming a publicly traded company, Chicago's Potbelly Sandwich Works is now being sold to convenience store operator Racetrack. Joining us with the details is R.J. Hadevi, head of analytical research at the Palo Alto-based foot traffic analysis firm Placer AI. RJ, thank you for joining us today. And before we talk about what this means for Potbelly, let's talk about where they are right now. Where does Potbelly fit in the overall sandwich marketplace? How does it stack up to Jimmy John's and to Subway?
Yeah, it's a great question, Rob. And honestly, the sandwich category out of all the other QSR categories has been one of the more pressured in recent years. Most of the growth coming out of the QSR sector has been driven by either the chicken category, groups like Raising Cane's and Chick-fil-A, as well as some of the hot chicken concepts like Dave's Hot Chicken, or the Mexican-inspired category as well. Taco Bell continues to grow. So it's been a category that's been somewhat pressured. Honestly, most of the chains within this have seen year-over-year visit declines at this point. And so struggling to kind of find their way and stand out in what has become a very crowded marketplace, not only among other restaurant operators, but also other channels like convenience stores, grocery, and others.
Now, the acquisition by Racetrack is it's one of their subsidiaries called Hero Sub, and it sounds like this means, because they operate a lot of convenience stores and gas stations, that maybe in the not-too-distant future you will find yourself at a highway rest stop somewhere, and a Potbelly Sub will be available. But the other thing about the Potbelly model versus Jimmy John's or Subway is that it's a lot slower than the other two sandwich shops. You pick the you pick the toppings, and then they're toasted, and it's a lot slower through the line because the ingredients are considered to be of higher quality. And how is that going to travel?
Yeah, it's a great question, and I think ultimately this is going to be a two-way street between the acquirer and the target here. For Racetrack, I think they get access to a unique concept, as you pointed out, something that obviously has Chicago roots and a differentiated product. Now, to make that work at some of the convenience stops or some of the potential gas stations that they have, there may be some changes in terms of equipment and things to make it better. But frankly, we have seen a movement the last couple of years that those chains like a Buc-ee's, a Wawa, a Sheetz, those that have really upgraded and enhanced their food program are outperforming the category. At the same time, I think because, as you mentioned, Racetrack is a largely franchised business with multiple banners, there is an opportunity to potentially accelerate growth for Potbelly as well. So it's as much about menu as it is real estate on this acquisition.
And then for Potbelly, it also means the end, in a way, for a locally owned and locally built business. Where did Potbelly, where did they take a wrong turn over the last couple of years to lead them to this acquisition?
Yeah, I think, honestly, I mean, the competition has been a big part of it. It's, the restaurant industry has always been very competitive, but particularly at the sandwich category, as we've seen a shift away from this category into others, I think that certainly played a part in it, too. I think overall migration, I mean, having a localized Midwest footprint where we've seen a lot of migration out the last couple of years certainly has not helped them either. So a number of factors, probably some industry and, consumer related, some probably self-inflicted as well. They probably admit that. So I think it was a couple of things that led to it. But I think under Racetrack, it's actually a very interesting acquisition and blurring of the lines between the quick service or fast food category and the convenience store category, which has already started to blur the last couple of years. So it'll be interesting to see how this all takes off and what the future of Potbelly holds.
RJ Hadevi, head of analytical research at the Palo Alto-based foot traffic analysis firm Placer AI. Thank you for joining us today. Coming up next, when markets look look best. The risk of becoming overextended can be at its highest.
The WBBM Noon Business Hour continues.
Many portfolios may be overextended or too risky. At all-time highs, things look fine, but corrections strike without warning, quickly turning good situations into bad ones. We welcome in Mark Hulbert, investment columnist for the Wall Street Journal, Barron's, and MarketWatch.com, based in Washington. Mark, thank you for joining us today. When it comes to assessing risk and whether or not your portfolio is overextended, do a lot of people know that they are in risky situations, or do they even know they're overextended?
Well, that's a great question. And I think in most cases, and especially when the market's at an all-time high like we are seeing in recent days, people have no idea what the risk tolerance really is. They'll look at a historical chart and notice that most of the time market corrections are overcome relatively quickly and the market continues this inexorable march upward, or what it seems to be. But in the moment itself, when you're down 20, 30 or 40% or more, in fact, several bear markets have been even more severe than that, it doesn't feel like that. And there's no guarantee the market will come back. And so part of the reason that market corrections can be so severe is that people don't think that it really is that bad. And so they underestimate the risk of the market as a whole and then of what their own risk tolerance is in their portfolio, which means the market's probably going to have to fall even further in order to bring it back into line with fundamentals like earnings and so forth.
And then when we talk about your risk tolerance, how does your time horizon impact your risk tolerance? Because we're all, many of us are veterans of the Great Recession and the 50% market pullback that took place during that time nearly 20 years ago. But if you stayed in the market and you continued investing, you came out looking pretty good on the other end because the market did come back. So if you have 15 or 20 years, how does that affect your risk tolerance?
Well, in theory, it should very much affect your risk tolerance, because if you had that kind of time horizon and really believed in it, and I'm going to come back to that point in a minute, then of course, as you say, the market will eventually bail you out. Time will heal all wounds and you'll come out a whole. The problem is that you have to have that discipline to hold on for that long. And most people who say they do, in fact, don't. And that is part of the problem. And so I think people kid themselves. They'll think, oh, well, I can withstand a drop of that magnitude, when in fact they cannot.
And then market behavior, I mean, there are certain trends that become apparent over time, but it also seems, especially in recent years coming out of the Great Recession, that market participants more often than not want to walk on the sunny side of the street, and that the market will continue to go up regardless of what happens, even defying some historical trends.
Well, that's right. And indeed, the market doesn't care about our irrationality, because what you describe of wanting everything always to go up is irrational behavior. And yet we believe in it. And I think perhaps the best historical example, which of course is a very scary one, is what happened in Japan in the wake of its all-time high in 1989. It wasn't until the last couple of years that the Japanese stock market actually made it back to where it was in 1989. So that was close to a 40-year period in which you would have been below water. And people say, well, that can't happen here. Well, that I think is a dangerous illusion. Of course it could happen here. It could happen anywhere.
Mark Hulbert, investment columnist for the Wall Street Journal, Barron's, and MarketWatch.com, based in Washington.
It's not coming from Brent Veach and Andy Reid, and it's not coming from Sean McVay. It's coming from the Cleveland Browns. And yeah, you're seeing exactly
you know
what
why
people
it's not,
outside of Cleveland
you know,
think of the Browns, outside of
you
Browns.
You know why it's not coming from those guys? Because they didn't draft him. They didn't want him to begin with. This was the one team that wanted him, and they're telling you he's behind. Maybe it's not a grand conspiracy. Maybe everybody is right, and the Shador fans, you wackos. Maybe it's your guy is just not ready. Maybe you got to come to grips with it.
The Ken Carmen Show with Anthony Lima on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your podcasts.
The WBBM Noon Business Hour continues.
Good afternoon. I'm Rob Hart. Markets are mixed at this hour. Joining us on the Village of Bedford Park business line, reminding you to bring your business home, is Jack Ablin, Chief Investment Strategist at Crescent Capital in Chicago. Jack, thank you for joining us today. And it seems like, well, let's talk about inflation here, because we have the Producer Price Index, which came out this morning, which came in cooler than analysts had anticipated. We have the Consumer Price Index coming out later this week. Do you believe that this let up in inflation is the beginning of a trend, or merely a runoff, merely a one-off, or a more troubling sign about the state of the economy?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really interesting question. I think if you ask me again tomorrow at this time, I could give you a better answer, Rob. PPI, certainly a lot better than expected. Probably more important is the CPI report that's due out tomorrow morning at 7:30. And there, I think this is really where the Fed's going to focus. These are obviously consumer prices. Keep in mind also that PPI last month was a lot stronger than expected. So perhaps this is just a pullback from the excessive price gains that we saw in the previous month.
Now, markets popped early in the session this morning on the belief that the Fed would be a little more aggressive when it came to cutting rates, because you do have a cooling job market, and if inflation is cooling along with it, then it's the green light to cut rates not only 25 basis points next week, or potentially show up with a 0.5% cut.
That's it. If you look at Fed funds futures now, it's calling for 3 rate cuts in September, October, and then December. And so that is up from between 1 and 2 cuts. So clearly we have a weak jobs market. That was the August jobs report showed really its worst reading since the pandemic. We're seeing pullbacks in construction hiring and in manufacturing. And most of the job gains we're seeing are in healthcare and education, both of which rely on government spending. So I do think that perhaps the job market is weaker than we originally thought. Combine that perhaps with better than expected inflation, and that paves the way for a rate cut path that the Fed can embark on.
I do want to talk about one story stock today, and that is Oracle. And it seems like the overarching theme when it comes to tech is AI rules everything around me. We talk about NVIDIA with their demand for chips powering AI everywhere around the world, but Oracle cashing in a big way on the demand for AI servers.
Yeah, that's it. And to me, this is really just the natural evolution of innovation. If we go back to the internet and other previous innovations, we look at it in sort of 3 stages: the hardware stage, what we'll call the platform stage, which is really where Oracle sits. And then really the biggest gain will likely be in the beneficiary stage. This is where companies outside the realm of AI start to harness that capability to either transform their business or create disruptive new industries. And just like perhaps Amazon of the internet days, where it just really took off for the races. So yes, we're certainly pleased that this evolution is taking place. And I think the platform providers are going to be the next series of gainers.
Jack Ablin, Chief Investment Strategist, Crescent Capital in Chicago. Thank you for joining us today. Coming up next in Personal Finance Wednesday, back to school season is the perfect time to teach kids smart money habits.
Investing 60 minutes each weekday for planning for the future. The WBBM Noon Business Hour continues.
It's Personal Finance Wednesday, sponsored by Consumers Credit Union. A new school year is the perfect time to teach your kids money skills through allowances, chores, saving jars, and even apps that turn small sums into lifelong lessons. We welcome in Shane Gornick, financial advisor, Forefront Financial Planning, based in Lisle. Find him online at preparemyretirement.com. Shane, thank you for joining us today on the Noon Business Hour. And when it comes to teaching kids proper money and saving skills early on, how does it avoid complicating your life as a financial advisor later on?
Well, the reality is kids simply aren't taught to effectively use money in school. And I think that rung true, Rob, when you and I were growing up, and it rings true today. And I don't think that's the fault of the schools. I just think that that's not really their job. And unfortunately, what that means is that when you don't learn those things early on in life, that extends to later on in life and learning expensive mistakes the hard way when learning these things when you are younger from your parents, setting things up a certain way, like we're going to talk about with allowances and things like that, can make them much more effectively prepared to handle them.
Yeah, kids want cash for lunches, sports, just cool stuff that they can buy at the store. And you can turn that into a lesson in earning money and saving money and learning about the value of money. But I also want to make sure that any advice that we dispense today on the program, Shane, also exists on planet Earth. Because you and I both have sixth graders at home, and I don't know about you, but by the time all the activities are done, by the time homework is done, by the time all of the household functions have been executed, everything is cleaned up, and you can finally turn the lights off for the day, it's 11:15 at night. And when in that very busy schedule can you impart lessons about money when you've got 75 million other things going on?
Well, I think a lot of it has to do with when you're out and about doing those 70 million things. So one part of it is, we like to look at kind of allowances as a two-part thing. So usually we'll look at setting a weekly amount that's not tied to regular chores, but it also corresponds with increasing financial responsibilities. So when you're out and about and they're wanting something and it's something that you might normally just say, oh, okay, I'll go ahead and get it for you, telling them, okay, well, how much money do you have on you, or are you able to afford it? And so you're not only giving them money, but you're giving them money and increasing their financial responsibilities so that they can recognize that that's actually going to happen. So if you're taking them to dance practice or something like that, and they want a bottle of Gatorade, or they want something random that you would normally get for them, give them an opportunity to get it on their own and see that there's actually money involved when it comes time to buying that.
Yeah, it seems like it's a very good lesson, and this is the budget, and once the budget has been met, it's over. There is no bailout coming from the bank of mom and dad.
Exactly, and we also don't like to just look at having a set month, a set weekly amount that's not tied to chores, because that part is meant to increase their ability to take on some smaller financial responsibilities on their own, but we also like to provide opportunity for them to earn extra money on a chore-by-chore basis. So, for example, in our household, our daughter has an opportunity if she walks the dog on certain nights. And it's not every night, but on certain nights, if she walks the dog, she'll get a couple dollars associated with that. So it's giving her also an incentive to do extra things beyond what's normally expected of her to try to get extra money as well.
And it also seems like this needs to be building a virtuous cycle. This should not be seen as punishment, as some type of a thing that you have to grit your teeth and just get through. Ideally, maybe you could gamify it. Maybe you could make it fun.
Oh, absolutely. And especially when there are opportunities to do extra things and trying to get more money. You know, you can have a chart, or you can have a whiteboard on your refrigerator where they are keeping track of how much money they have and how much a certain purchase is a certain toy or something that they want to buy, and seeing, okay, how many times are we going to have to walk the dog, or how many weeks are we going to have to wait in order to be able to do this? And it really helps them kind of get a better sense of how money actually works, and helping prepare them for the real world when they get older.
Shane Gornick, financial advisor, Forefront Financial Planning in Lyle. Find him online at preparemyretirement.com. Thank you for joining us today.
Discussing the news affecting your money, the WBBM Noon Business Hour continues.
Mortgage demand is picking up as mortgage rates continue to go down. With a look at the mortgage market right now, we welcome in Brian Wickard, president and owner of Accudent Mortgage in Waukesha, Wisconsin. Brian, thank you for joining us today on the Noon Business Hour. The average rate for a 30-year fixed-rate mortgage is down at roughly 6.5%. That is down from 6.64% very recently. And whenever there's a little bit of a sign of lower mortgage rates, I would imagine that mortgage activity picks up in a big way. That's just the nature of the housing market today. And can we anticipate more relief if the Fed cuts again?
Well, that's a great question. I actually have three don'ts to share with our listeners today. And the first is you don't have to wait, because today's mortgage rates are even lower than what you just quoted from the, I think that was from the most recent Freddie Mac report. They're even lower than they are today. But you don't have to wait, because next week's Fed rate cut and at least two more rate cuts the rest of the year are already baked into today's mortgage rates. So you don't have to wait.
And also, I mean, we talk about the federal funds rate. If the Fed cuts, and they most likely will, that doesn't really govern mortgage rates. It's the 10-year bond yield that really governs where mortgage rates are going and at what speed. And last year, when the Fed cut by half a percentage point back in September, the 10-year yield popped. So whatever savings exactly you could have realized from that never really happened. But today, the 10-year yield is tantalizingly close to a 3-handle. And what does that mean for you if you're trying to determine when's a good time to jump in and jump into the housing market?
Right. Here's what I think a person has to do is you have to be cognizant of your loan amount, right? Because if you've only got a $50,000 loan amount, refinancing isn't going to do you a lot of good. But if you've got a $500,000 loan amount, boy, dropping that rate, you know, let's say from 7 to 6.5, that'll save you $167 a month. Going down 0.75%, that's $250 a month. So you have to be aware, what can you do right now, right? Because waiting has a risk, as you just pointed out. We don't know what's going to happen, you know, next week or the week after that. So find out what you can do today. And I'd say a good rule of thumb is if your rate is 6.99 or higher, you should be looking at options. My second don't for people to consider is don't assume your current lender will offer you a better deal or an easier refinance process. Shop around a little bit. And my third don't is don't confuse the amount of cash you bring to closing on a refi with the cost, because while you're looking at the payment savings and the drop in the rate, you also have to be very keenly aware of what am I actually spending to get this refinance done.
Brian Wickert, president and owner of Accudent Mortgage in Waukesha, Wisconsin. Thank you for joining us today.
It's not coming from Brent Veach and Andy Reid, and it's not coming from Sean McVay. It's coming from the Cleveland Browns. And yeah, you're seeing exactly,
you know,
what
why
people
it's not,
outside of Cleveland,
you know,
think of the Browns, outside of Browns.
You know
fans.
Why it's not coming from those guys? Because they didn't draft him. They didn't want him to begin with. This was the one team that wanted him, and they're telling you he's behind. Maybe it's not a grand conspiracy. Maybe everybody is right, and the Shador fans, you wackos. Maybe it's your guy is just not ready. Maybe you got to come to grips with it.
The Ken Carmen Show with Anthony Lima on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your podcasts.